Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Today on the pod, Doug Ford's mandate letters to cabinet ministers will remain secret after the Supreme Court of Canada sides with the Premier.
Toronto Mayor Olivia Chow's gambit to keep Toronto's tax hike only high-ish seems to have paid off.
Ontario Power Generation will refurbish the Pickering Nuclear Generating Station and get many more years of service out of the province's first nuclear power plant.
And for your column, my column, I will be focusing on that issue of the Pickering refurbishment.
And I'll focus on a former cabinet minister who at age 79 made the discovery of a lifetime.
It's Tuesday, February 6th, 2024, so let's get to it.
Howdy, partner. Here we are. Is this our last audio-only podcast?
I believe, yes. This is our last time in this windowless audio room.
Yeah. Well, we have one window and through which we can see Matthew, our producer, but otherwise nothing outdoors. So this is it. From now on, we got to wear appropriate clothing from now on then, because we're going to be on video as well.
I'm going to have to shave in the mornings before
yes,
a podcast.
Yes, you will. Yes, you will. And bathe. I would, you know, that would be a good thing.
Well, given how cramped we are, I have been bathing here.
Glad to hear that. Now, have you seen the hottest new t-shirt these days for sale?
I think I know what's coming. I believe I've seen it, but please do go on.
Well, it's a shirt that will no doubt be popular with municipal politicians across Ontario because it simply says, "That's provincial. Thanks for asking." And as you might imagine, this started from a municipal politician by the name of Cam Guthrie, who is the mayor of Guelph. And apparently he said that to someone in answer to a question about why he wasn't taking care of some particular problem. And thus a slogan was born. And so apparently was a new popular t-shirt.
You know, I do love this side of Canadian government because we have federal government, we have provincial government, we have municipal governments, and with so many issues, that is exactly the issue. They can all point at each other. You know, 20 years ago, I was door knocking in a provincial by-election, and a guy started yelling at us about how his property taxes had gone up so much under the mayor of the day. And I had to say, well, actually, that one's not us. one of my colleagues got substantially more aggressive in trying to rebut this issue. And I was at a certain point, I was like, you know what? Let's just pull this guy off of the doorstep, because at the end of the day, this is an important point to know, the division of powers among Canadian governments. Mm-hmm. But when you're trying to convince somebody to vote for you, saying, actually, that one's not our fault, is of limited utility,
well,
I discovered.
Let's put it this way. You might have been 20 years ahead of your time, because Cam Guthrie, apparently the mayor, has said, hey, that's provincial. Thanks for asking. So seems to be working for him. Maybe you were just ahead of your time. Let's get to the mailbag. We do enjoy getting your feedback at this email address, onpolitics@tvo.org. And JMM, why don't you stick your hand in that mailbag and pluck something out for this week?
This week, we have a letter from listener Gabriel Lawrence, who has a question about Service Ontario. Very timely. He writes, hi, Steve and John. I can't wait until the little red dot on my Pocket Cast shows on Poly, meaning I have a new episode to listen to. Thanks for making the best local podcast out there.
Nice.
Thank you. It would be interesting to take a deeper dive into how that structure is currently working, the structure of putting Service Ontario kiosks in Staples locations. My understanding is that they are currently owned by small businesses, owner-operator type arrangements, and they are being told that their businesses will be shutting down in 60 days' notice. I love the quote, take care of the pennies and the dollars will take care of themselves. I don't see what the controversy is here. Either this makes financial sense and makes visiting a Service Ontario more convenient for Ontarians, longer hours, or it doesn't. We'll see what the Auditor General says about it. Thanks for everything you do. Best, Gabe.
Thanks for that, Gabe. That's great. Okay, just as we get set to take a kick at this, Monday morning, you saw the press conference that Premier Ford had with Olivia Chow?
I did indeed, yes.
Okay, and you saw that Richard Southern from City News tried to ask a question about this, and the Premier really kind of, you said, oh, Richard, you're a dog with a bone with this thing. Let it go, Ben. It's over and done with already. Richard's getting under his skin a little bit.
I don't love elected officials of any party or order of government telling journalists what they should and should not be writing.
And I think Richard probably did not take the premier's advice. And his response was, well, just release the study upon which your policy is based and I'd be happy to go away. But I don't think that's going to happen. Anyway, Gabe, back to you. Service Ontario was established, actually not in, under the current government, but it goes all the way back to 2006 under Dalton McGuinty's Liberal government. It was meant to be a one-stop shop for government services, including driver's licenses, birth certificates, health cards, and the like. Back in the day before Service Ontario outlets existed, this is where I come in with my firsthand knowledge about way back when. If you wanted to get your driver's license renewed, you actually had to go downtown to the McDonald block at Queen's Park, Bay and Wellesley, take a number, and then you sat there with everybody else, sometimes for half an hour, sometimes for an hour. If you went on lunch hour, you know, there's a lot of people there, or depending on what day of the week you went, you know, Fridays were never great either. And then you got your renewal. It was not, shall we say, the most customer-friendly of circumstances. Now, as the years moved on, Service Ontario sites were created, and then the private sector joined in and provided those services as well. For example, a little over 10 years ago, there were 82 Service Ontario sites, 82, but there were also 207 privately owned sites, and they were extremely profitable. Why so many privately owned sites? Mr. McGrath will pick up the story from there.
Well, the short version is that many locations are privately owned because businesses can apply to open a location there. There's an online portal and they get a contract under the Ministry of Government and Consumer Services. There are, of course, plenty of provincial services that are licensed out through private providers. One that our listeners might be most familiar with is retailing lottery tickets, right? When a convenience store sells you a lottery ticket, they are doing it under contract to Ontario Lottery and Gaming. Most Service Ontario locations are owned by private operators, but it isn't purely privately run. Service Ontario runs the mailrooms, contact centers, online services, and a lot of the public infrastructure, so to speak, that the private operators rely on to make the whole system work.
And let's bring the story back to today. At least 11 privately run Service Ontario locations are now being moved into Staples stores, and we will have to wait and see what the Auditor General reports back on in terms of the value for money on that deal.
We've already mentioned his name, but really kudos to our colleague Richard Southern for sticking with this story and chasing, well, first breaking it and then chasing it as well. Again, if you'd like to ask about content on the show, do please email us at onpolitics@tvo.org. Now, on to issue one.
We're going to start this week's podcast talking about mandate letters. Now, these are essentially the marching orders that premiers give to their cabinet ministers with a greater or lesser amount of detail on what they expect their ministers to achieve in their portfolios. The previous Liberal government under Premier Kathleen Wynne always made mandate letters public. For whatever reason, the current Doug Ford government never has. So the CBC took them to court to try to get those mandate letters made public, and the Supreme Court has ruled. Last Friday, they came in with their verdict. Sorry, CBC, the Premier can keep his mandate letters secret if he wants. John Michael, why don't you take us through the ruling?
So just for starters, this is not like a charter case, right? There's no charter right to see these mandate letters. This was basically a question of the courts interpreting what Ontario's law says and whether it was being properly interpreted. So there are constitutional conventions that underpin this particular law. We're talking about the Freedom of Information and Privacy Protection Act, basically Ontario's primary Freedom of Information law. And it has a very broad exemption in the law for cabinet documents, any kind of advice to cabinet or anything that would inform the public about the way that debates at cabinet proceeded, because there is a long tradition in our sort of parliamentary system of cabinet secrecy. The Provincial Information and Privacy Commissioner had ruled that the mandate letters that Ford issued his cabinet in 2018 were not like a summary of the debates that occurred in cabinet, but they were basically products of those debates in the same way that like a government policy announcement or a press release is a product of cabinet debates.
And therefore could be revealed.
Exactly. And in fact, were required to be under the legislation. two lower courts had actually agreed with the Information and Privacy Commissioner, but the Supreme Court of Canada, in their decision last week, did not. They said that the Privacy Commissioner and the lower courts had really read cabinet confidentiality too narrowly, and that releasing the mandate letters would harm cabinet confidentiality, and that you have to understand that these mandate letters don't just come out and that's the end of the policymaking process. They are part of a whole continuum of activity. The ministers then go back and they make policy based on these mandate letters, and then those policies that get back to cabinet where they are debated more and more. And so the Supreme Court said basically, no, the government can choose to release these letters, or it could also choose to rewrite the legislation. But as the law is written now, and with the constitutional conventions that we have, the government is not required to release these letters.
And when you say the Supreme Court decided, you really mean the whole Supreme Court decided. This was a slam dunk for the Premier. He got 7 votes and none against.
Right. There was one minor dissent, but not on the substantive issue here of all of the justices of the Supreme Court agreed that the lower courts had read the law wrong, basically, and that the this convention of cabinet secrecy was so important that it had to be respected.
Now, opposition reaction. Bonnie Crombie, the new Liberal leader, released a statement after the decision was made public saying if she has the honor of forming the next government of Ontario after the next election, she would make public her ministerial mandate letters if she is the premier. Marit Stiles, who is the opposition leader, the official opposition leader in the House today, was adamant that she would do the same.
I would absolutely share the mandate letters. You can hear it. I think that this has become a fair and important practice of governments to share those mandate letters. I think it's symbolic, I think, that a government wants to share their priorities with the people of Ontario. I think hiding those mandate letters sends a signal to Ontarians that you're not being upfront and honest. There's something going on behind the scenes that people should be worried about.
So let's get into this. Why do you think the government, John Michael, has repeatedly refused to make these mandate letters public when many other governments in the country are doing just that?
Well, so obviously there's the fact that these letters do give some insight into the government's priorities. And frankly, they make it very clear when the government doesn't reach one of its goals. One of those goals, for instance, was to cut hospital wait times. But look around. The government has not exactly succeeded on that mark. Government wait times are continuing to be high, are in fact getting longer in many places. So that's obviously a little embarrassing for the government. You know, I do think there is a more sincere explanation, if I could put it that way, that, you know, there is a balance between what the public wants to know and the importance of cabinet confidentiality. The Supreme Court's decision was an attempt to balance those two principles. Obviously, you know, I think I could say as journalists, we default towards wanting to see more disclosure. And I kind of wish from that perspective that the mandate letters had been released. But of course, well, they have been, but we can talk about that separately. You know, I do want to say people might be asking, like, why should we care about cabinet confidentiality? And I do think it's worth just stressing here that we have this norm of what we call cabinet solidarity, right? Once cabinet has made a decision, every cabinet minister is expected to defend the policy of the government, whatever they said behind closed doors.
Or resign if you can't.
Exactly, right? And so part of the way you make that work is by allowing cabinet to debate things in private, secretly, and you hope that cabinet is debating things forcefully and frankly, and ministers may be yelling at each other behind closed doors, but then, you know, once they come out, they have, you hope, again, arrived at the best possible policy that everybody can defend, and so protecting cabinet confidentiality is ideally part of preserving the best result from government. The Supreme Court said in its decision that, you know, cabinet secrecy promotes what they said, candor, solidarity, efficiency, all in the aid of effective government and responsible government, our system of parliamentary government here in Canada. I did, of course, allude to the fact that the letters actually have been released. Global News did publish them in September last year. The letters highlighted things like scrapping the carbon tax, removing the CEO of Hydro One. It's kind of a deep cut. People might remember that clip from the archives. And objectives like, as we mentioned, cutting hospital wait times.
So that's a big win for the Premier on the mandate letters issue. And with that, we move on to issue two. Well, the tone between the federal government and the mayor of Toronto was decidedly improved last week. Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland brought a check to Olivia Chow for $162 million, much of that going toward housing assistance. You know, it was only a few weeks ago that Liberal MPs were fanning out, criticizing Chow for not being a team player. But apparently, that's all ancient history now. JMM, what happened?
Well, I don't think our listeners are mystified by some facts, like the fact that Toronto is currently a Liberal stronghold federally. The Conservative Party of Canada, however, does have a really substantial lead in national polling. So the Liberals are pretty interested in holding on to their power in this city, you know, 25 seats to hold on to here. 25 seats doesn't mean as much as it does nationally as it does provincially, but still, you want to hold those seats if you can. So the pressure that Mayor Chow brought to this game, in particular the threat to name a potential tax increase as the federal impacts levy, you know, a bit of hardball there, and it yeah. did put the federal Liberals into a bind.
Well, and this was not the only example of the feds getting along so much better with another order of government. Dominic LeBlanc, who is a longtime cabinet minister, Minister of Public Safety, joined Premier Doug Ford last week in Aurora, just north of Toronto, to announce a $121 million partnership to crack down on guns and gang violence. What do we think about this development of peace breaking out all over?
Well, you know, I think the status quo works for everybody who is currently in power, right? Sort of by definition. But there's also, I think, the really long-running historical trend that Ontarians don't really like to put the same party in power, both in Ottawa and at Queen's Park at the same time. So it is in Ford's interest to keep the Liberals in power federally, maybe not ideologically, but certainly politically. Like, I think in his heart of hearts, he would like the results that might come from a Prime Minister Poilievre, but not if it causes Ontario voters to think about how happy they are with Premier Ford. Mm-hmm. We discussed a bit of this last week. You know, Poilievre and Ford aren't really close political allies the way you might expect them to be. Ford has a reasonably close relationship with the federal government. Some of that was forged during COVID, of course. And a change federally could be difficult in some ways for Canada's most populous and economically prosperous province. I mean, just one example that the Premier was talking about this week is all of the investments they've made in electric vehicle infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's controversial to say that the federal government might not be ponying up a lot of cash for electric vehicles if there's a change in government and a Conservative Party forms government. You know, what does that mean for Ontario's auto sector?
The short answer is you just don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I read something this past week which suggested that since Confederation, different parties have been in power federally and provincially in Ottawa and at Queen's Park something like 80 to 85% of the time. I mean, this is a thing. This is a thing. Now, let me circle back to the mayor of Toronto for a second, because and to do that, let's reach into the mailbag yet again for something from a listener by the name of Saad. And he writes, "Hi, John, Michael and Steve. Love the show. It's been a great companion on many commutes. As someone in the GTA, I try to keep an eye on what's going on here, even though it's difficult. I've noticed that Mayor Olivia Chow's approval rating has risen quite rapidly. I'm wondering what you two believe the main factors of this rise are. I know that she's made some big moves with both the provincial and federal governments and has improved some social services, but public opinion shifting this positively is rare. Further, do you think her increased approval rating will meaningfully improve the NDP's chances federally and provincially if it remains relatively steady? Once again, love the show. Look forward to hearing the next episode with curiosity." What a nice sign off. With curiosity, Saad. Okay, let's divvy this one up. As to why Mayor Chao's approval ratings are so high, and the last poll I saw put that number at 71% approval. Joe Biden's below 30. Okay, Olivia Chow's at 71. That is a terrific number. And I would suggest part of the reason is because she came into office with very low expectations. She did not get a particularly high number of votes on by-election day, but she has simply outperformed people's expectations. Brian Mulroney used to have this line, the former prime minister. He'd say, "Don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative." And seen through that lens, Mayor Chao is looking pretty good right now. She's had some significant wins from both the feds and the province. And let's also remember, though, she's only been in office for about a half a year so far, and she is about to put through a big tax increase, biggest one in years and years, through City Hall in hopes of getting the budget closer to balance, which it still isn't. So, Saad, as we know, popularity is a fickle thing, but at the moment the consensus seems to be she's doing quite well. Now, let's get to the second part of Saad's question, JMM. Given that Chao is a former New Democrat member of parliament, do you think she's got the kind of coattails that could help the provincial or even federal NDP?
You know, I love this kind of a question because it is so hard to predict how politics will go. I was thinking earlier today about 2015 when Justin Trudeau won, and he won in part because of some substantial public assistance that then Premier Wynne gave him during that election. I think it was probably the most effusive we've ever seen a premier lobby or campaign on behalf of a fellow partisan at the federal level. And a lot of Wynne liberals at the time believed that when Trudeau won that huge majority in 2015, they thought that the Trudeau government would owe Ontario and would owe the Wynne government.
That's
not the way the coattails work.
Doesn't work that way.
I find myself thinking about this question of could Olivia Chao benefit the federal or provincial NDP? My instinct is to say not so much federally. I don't think that being the mayor of Toronto is a nationally significant job. I think that's true, but I don't think it will translate to national politics the same way. Provincially is another question, and I do think that the demographics of the province alone mean that having the prominence of somebody like Chao at literally like the center of the GTA media market, she's in the headlines, all the time. If she starts sort of noisily campaigning for the NDP, that could help Marit Stiles potentially. But the question then would be, would she do that? There's going to be a provincial election before there will be the next municipal election. And the traditional wisdom is that mayors want to be careful about how much they wade into provincial politics because you could so easily, burn your bridges. And Olivia Chao, if she does in fact get reelected, she's going to have to work with whoever's in the premier's office.
And she's taken quite a lot of pains to not promote herself, both when she was running for the job and since then as a partisan New Democrat. So that's, that's also worth taking into the mix here. And of course, there was that lovely stuff between that Doug Ford said yesterday morning, right?
Well, exactly. Yeah. And, you never know how much of this is purely performance, but I don't think it's entirely performance. Mayor Chao got really effusive praise from Doug Ford at a press conference held Monday this week.
I can tell you one thing. The mayor and I have a phenomenal relationship. We're doing some great things together. We're going to continue to work collaboratively, but I have all the confidence. The mayor's doing a good job and the councillors down there. It's about working together, and that's exactly what we're going to do.
Well, it just goes to show you, 7-8 months ago, she was an unmitigated disaster, according to the premier, but now they have a phenomenal relationship. So we just love it when peace breaks out all over, don't we?
Time heals all things.
There we go. Okay, on to issue 3.
Last week, Energy Minister Todd Smith announced that the government is supporting Ontario Power Generation's plan to refurbish the Pickering Nuclear Generating Station in the eastern GTA. They're investing $2 billion in engineering and design work, but the project could cost billions more and will take about a decade to complete. The refurbishment comes at a time when Ontario's electricity demands are set to skyrocket. Joining us to discuss this and more is Dr. Chris Kiefer, an emergency medical physician and president of Canadians for Nuclear Energy. Dr. Kiefer, thanks for joining us on the On Poly podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So your organization, Canadians for Nuclear Energy, has been advocating for the government to retain Pickering's foremost modern reactors for, I believe, about a year. What did you think when you heard the news?
I mean, I think it's great news on a whole number of levels. We've been fighting this campaign since 2020 as a nonprofit volunteer organization independent from industry. And we were really driven by the climate imperative. Pickering displaces an enormous amount of emissions. If it had been shut, we're looking at 7.6 million transatlantic flights worth of CO2. It produces an enormous amount of medical isotopes. 20% of the world's single-use medical devices are sterilized with cobalt-60 made right there at Pickering. And Pickering played a pivotal role in Ontario's coal phase-out, which eliminated smog days here in Toronto and have saved many hundreds of lives, as estimated by the Ontario Medical Association, by, again, providing the power for our nuclear-powered coal phase-out, North America's greatest greenhouse gas reduction.
You are a medical doctor by training. You come at this from, I think, a different lens than economists or energy systems analysts. I mean, what to you are the important health implications of retaining this nuclear reactor and expanding, in fact, the use of nuclear energy in Ontario as this government is doing?
Yeah, so I began practice at the very beginning of our coal phase. We used to rely on coal for 25% of our electricity here in Ontario. And again, that the Ontario Medical Association, actually in partnership with our friends at the Ontario Clean Air Alliance, did a lot of work and research and built momentum for that momentous phase out of fossil energy. They estimated that 19,000 premature deaths were occurring every year in Ontario due to air pollution, to which coal was a major contributor. The reactivation of two units that had been mothballed at Pickering played a role alongside four reactivated Bruce Power units, and that made dramatic improvements in air quality across the province. And definitely anecdotally in my clinical practice, I've seen less asthma exacerbations, less emphysema exacerbations, but we know as well there's a real hidden disease burden with particulate air pollution in terms of vascular disease like heart attacks and strokes and cancer. So Pickering's played a major role in that. The IESO confirmed that it would be replaced with natural gas had it been shut, or certainly it will be for the years that it is undergoing refurbishment. Natural gas burns cleaner than coal, but definitely contributes chemical precursors of smog, and ultimately also is, you know, quite a climate pollutant. So, you know, from the long-term impacts of climate change, there's a medical good news story here, but from the more proximate impacts that I've seen in my medical career, Pickering has played a vital role. It was built instead of a coal plant. And so for its entire life, it's done amazing things in terms of, you know, making our air quality far superior than it would be otherwise.
Notwithstanding the work that yourself and other nuclear advocates have done in Ontario, there are still plenty of people who have misgivings about nuclear power. How do you reassure people who are afraid of potential dangers associated with nuclear energy?
It's interesting. I mean, I think the debate is maturing. We're moving past the sort of Simpsons era. And frankly, you know, the Cold War boomer era. And I don't mean that pejoratively. My dad, dearly beloved, recently passed father, I mean, he was anti-nuclear. You know, I spent quite a while arguing with him, and it's a testament to his open-mindedness that he was able to change his opinions. But yeah, I mean, he had duck and cover drills during the Cold War. And a lot of the fear of nuclear power, unfortunately, comes from the world of nuclear weapons. And so, you know, our fears about radiation, for instance, are hugely exaggerated because of that very real fear. And let's not kid ourselves, nuclear weapons are still out there. That being said, I mean, as a medical physician, I dose people with radiation every day, sometimes in excess of doses they would get from the world's worst nuclear accidents. We're talking about full body CT scans, for instance, that in a moment, in a flash, will provide a dose of radiation greater than, the 6 million people closest to Chernobyl got in 20 years. So when you have the kind of medical understanding, you're able to put these risks in context. And in fact, you know, Canada has a perfect track record in terms of causing any, you know, injuries or deaths due to radiation from our nuclear sector. I think we have the safest nuclear reactor technology in the world. And so, you know, I try and empathize with people who, oppose nuclear power. I think that their concerns are based in, you know, a real lived experience. And I want to acknowledge that and try and communicate as best I can to hopefully dispel some of those fears.
Aside from the potential environmental or human health risks that people have anxiety about, there is also the issue of cost. Certainly, historically, we had cost overruns with the Darlington reactor's initial construction. Now, the refurbishment of Darlington and Bruce seems to be going relatively according to plan and on budget from all of the publicly available information. But what confidence should we have that Pickering refurbishment, which is going to be a very different type of work. It's an older design, a different design, a different facility than Darlington and Bruce. How confident should we be that this project won't, in fact, go over budget?
Well, first off, nuclear, like hydroelectricity, is a capital-intensive project that has an excellent long-term value proposition. And in terms of the cost of refurbishment, I mean, these are eye-watering numbers. As we see at Bruce, those refurbishments are going to cost, when all is said is done, I think about $12 billion. But that is absorbed in a rate that Bruce is getting paid on contract below market value. I believe 8.1 cents per kilowatt hour is absorbing $12 billion in refurbishment costs. So the sheer amount of electricity coming out of these plants, I think, is hard for the layperson and even myself to comprehend. But these refurbishments still contribute to Ontario's second cheapest source of electricity being nuclear, only undercut by hydroelectricity. In terms of Pickering, you rightly mentioned, it is a different plant than that at Bruce and Darlington, but you'll hear a lot of people say this is the oldest nuclear plant in the country. What is being refurbished are the four reactors on the B side, which are actually about 5 or 6 years newer than four of the reactors under refurbishment over at Bruce. It requires some similar work at Darlington and some similar work at Bruce, where, for instance, steam generators need to be replaced. That was done at Bruce. So this is all stuff that's within the wheelhouse of the refurbishment work that's happened at the other nuclear plants. It is going to be a little bit more complicated for some of the reasons that you mentioned, but our refurbishments have been coming in significantly ahead of schedule and under budget, which is a true miracle in the Western world, frankly, when it comes to any mega project. And we only have to look at hydroelectric dams like Site C and Muskrat Falls, massive delays, double over budget, airports, bridges, subways, light rail trains. So we've accomplished something pretty remarkable here. It's taken a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, but we have incredible human resources, incredibly skilled project managers, and institutional excellence. So without that, and you try and do big nuclear projects, they don't go well. And we've seen that in the US and Europe recently. With that, you have the kind of things we're doing here in Ontario, and I think we should be immensely proud in what we're achieving.
All that said, we're also in the midst of a global industrial or economic shift, really seeing enormous progress made in renewable energies. The costs of solar and wind and batteries have all come down, and some batteries are coming down rapidly. The International Energy Agency now says solar and wind are basically the cheapest electricity technologies available for the global market. Why then is nuclear the correct choice for Ontario, as I suspect you would say it is?
Well, it's because electricity, like healthcare, is a service, not a commodity. So it's true that when the wind is blowing and the sun is shining, there's really nothing cheaper than those resources on the grid. The reality is, a lot of the time, they are not. Wind and solar are what I call fair weather friends. And so, as I was mentioning, like healthcare, in my emergency department, we need to be running 24 hours a day, and we need to be able critically to plan for and accommodate increased flows of patients, horrible car accidents, mass casualty incidents. We need to be able to mobilize those resources. And so wind and solar, if you were to continue on that healthcare analogy, are a bit like doctors and nurses that will work for almost free when they feel like it. And a solar nurse is never going to work a night shift, right? And, the experiments have been run around the world. In places where we've deployed the most wind and solar, we have the highest electricity prices. California, for instance, highest costs in the continental US, Germany, Denmark, these are leaders in renewables deployments. Their grids aren't anywhere as clean as Ontario's, and their costs are very high. We're also living through the legacy now of the Green Energy Act, these 20-year feed-in tariff contracts that paid far above market rate to try and incentivize the wind and solar industry in Ontario, which never materialized. And you know, the total cost of that wind and solar build-out is estimated to be $62 billion when all is said and done. $3.1 billion every single year to pay these private developers. Never forget that we privatized a good chunk of our electricity system here for these very lucrative contracts. So everything's got to be put into context. Again, the Ontario Electricity Board regulates the prices that generators are paid. Nuclear is second cheapest at 10 cents, hydro at 8.1, wind 15, solar 50 cents per kilowatt hour. So nuclear is five times cheaper than solar, at least here in Ontario.
The Minister of Energy was asked if the government should be pursuing renewables. And he, I believe I'm going from my memory here, but he said that an alternative scenario for Pickering would require 18,000 megawatts of wind and 2,000 megawatts of battery storage, much more construction than the 2,000 megawatt nuclear reactor that we're talking about at Pickering. Do you have any sense of what that would cost?
Based on recent numbers coming out of Nation Rise, which is a very new wind farm, we've costed that 18 gigawatts of wind would cost $41 billion. The amount of batteries required, 12 gigawatt hours, $9.6 billion based on the cost of the battery farm going in on the Oneida Nation near Hamilton. So these are truly massive costs. And you might say, well, do you really need that much wind? This is more than a tripling of the Ontario wind fleet. Here's the thing about wind. It's, again, a fair weather friend. It doesn't show up when it's most needed. So Ontario's grid is under the most strain during summer when you have this massive air conditioning load. There's a period in 2019, this is not ancient past, where wind was performing at 6% of its capacity, 6.8%, I'll be more generous, for two-week period, right? What we're seeing with our nuclear fleet is, although they're baseload generators, because we have a fleet, we can match their output. So we do maintenance in the spring and fall when we least need the energy, and we run all out in the summer. Pickering set a site record this year for most production. And they had all six of their reactors running at 100% for 100 days throughout our highest demand season. So there again, you get this sense of the value proposition of these different resources and why you need so much wind and so much batteries if you're going to try and attempt the preposterous thing of replacing baseload with intermittent generation.
Dr. Kiefer, any final thoughts before we say goodbye?
Oh man, there's so much here. I mean, again, making this assessment of the value of various investments, the CANDU fleet that we have in Ontario to date in adjusted dollars, 2021 dollars, $58 billion, and has generated 17 times more electricity than the wind and solar fleet will generate at the end of those contracts we were discussing earlier. That wind and solar fleet, again, $62 billion in lifetime costs and producing 17 times less energy. The only other thing I'd add is in additional cost to the renewable cost shift, that $3.1 billion that we spend every year to pay off these lucrative contracts we're stuck in, we also lose about $1 billion a year because wind displaces another very low cost and ultra low emission source of electricity. And that would be our hydroelectric dams. So when the wind is gusting in spring and fall and we don't need it, we spill water at those hydroelectric facilities. And that ends up costing us another billion a year. So this is complex stuff. There's a nice story to getting our electricity and our energy from natural flows of energy like the wind and sun. But we're back in the land of mechanical engineering and physics with the machines that are required to harvest this energy. And what it means is sprawling wind turbines across vast landscapes, super large solar farms, or what looks like, you know, a large nuclear plant, but again, which provides a huge amount of the power to keep the GTA alight at night. So these are things which don't fit easily into narratives, but hopefully I've done a decent job here trying to shine a bit of light on this sector.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Chris Kiefer, President of Canadians for Nuclear Energy.
Now, just before we go to our regular feature, Your Column, My Column, we want to return to something that we do from time to time when there's something cute to present, and that's a feature we call Quote of Note. And this is a moment from Monday of this week's news conference, where Doug Ford was trying to be complimentary to a reporter from the Globe and Mail, and, well, let's just say he might have missed a little something in translation. Here we go.
But, Jeff, I got to compliment the Globe and Mail, and this is a rarity, folks. Great article. I don't know if you read it, Jeff, but it was
Oh,
you wrote it. Okay, good.
You're supposed to compliment mine, I think.
You know something? I didn't see you wrote it. I usually just watch the headline. So congratulations, Jeff. No, that's a great story. I thought it was part of Bloomberg, so you did it. Good for you.
Well, okay, he loved the story. I guess, like most, you know, it's reflective of one thing, and that is most people, you and I and all the other people in journalism, we pay close attention to bylines, right? Who writes the stories that we read? Most people don't. And the premier just proved it. He sure doesn't.
Yeah, no, I've had never with the premier or I don't think it's ever happened with a cabinet minister either. But I've definitely had that occasion where somebody has, you know, walked up to me and said, hey, did you read this thing? And I'm like, well, read it. I read a few drafts of it, actually.
Particularly because you wrote it.
Yes, exactly.
There you go.
Yeah, no, and you know, it's always a bit fun. Actually, it also happens a lot on social media where, you know, somebody will say, like, read this article if you want to understand that, you know, somebody thinks that they're totally dunking on you, and it's actually like, I actually wrote that. So.
Nice try. Okay, let's get to our regular feature, Your Column, My Column, where JMM and I reminisce about columns that we wrote for the website tvo.org over the past week. Mr. McGrath, what are you going to start us off with?
I did write about the decision to refurbish the Pickering nuclear station. You know, one thing that we haven't really talked about on the podcast today that I sort of deal with in that column was the fact that, I mean, one data point that I think probably encouraged the government to really focus on this issue about extending the lifespan of the Pickering station is that the nuclear plant is already there, and so are all the transmission lines mm-hmm. that move the electricity from the power plant to the rest of the grid.
And the public acceptance of it being there is
right.
also there.
Yes. Pickering, like not that many other places in this province, has a constituency of people who are basically, you know, if not happy to have the blue-collar unionized jobs, they are also happy to have, they are at least resigned to it, so, you know, and there's just not that many places in the province where you can say that. And I think at some point we probably will have to talk about siting large new power plants in the province. But right now, I think one of the things that's so appealing for the government is that they don't have to have that specific fight.
Right.
More of that will be coming in the future, I'm sure. But for now, this, you know, the headline was, this is the path of least resistance. Some people, I think, took that as more of an endorsement of the policy than I intended it as. But yeah, I think that's at least one thing motivating the government.
Good.
How about yourself, Steve?
You know, some people ask you, where do you get your stories from? Where do you get your, you know, your ideas for columns from? And sometimes it is just total serendipity, and that's what happened to me last week. I was talking to a former cabinet minister from the Brian Mulroney years, a guy by the name of John McDermott, who was the MP for Brampton Georgetown. And we were talking about a completely different subject when he just sort of, oh, by the way, Steve, by the by, I had the most astonishing, remarkable thing happen to me in the past few years. Can I tell you about it? And he did. And I thought, this is such a phenomenal story. I want to write a column about it. And so I did. Mr. McDermott was adopted. He knew he had been adopted at the age of 3 weeks old. He was the result of a high school fling between his birth mother and some guy Mr. McDermott never knew. But 5 years ago, at the prompting of a friend, he decided to do ancestry DNA, and he discovered at the age of 79 that he had a whole mess of biological brothers and sisters that he never knew about. He was an only child, adopted by somebody and was therefore an only child, and essentially had no family that he knew of, and he also, in his two marriages, never had any children himself. So he thought he had a fairly small family. Turns out he has an enormous family, and he's made contact with all of them, and apparently it's been a wonderful thing for everyone. It's such a feel-good story, and, you know, so I've brought it to their attention. And to learn this late in life, the identities of his birth mother, his birth father, and then discover that you are actually part of a family where you have multiple siblings. I think I'm trying to remember how many altogether. I think it was four from one side, maybe two more from his four from his mom's side, two more from his dad's side. It's just a beautiful story.
You know, I have, I think, a well-established division of labor in this podcast where I you know, handle a lot of, like, wonky detail stuff. And one of the things you really excel at is, like, reminding our listeners, and I think you do this on the agenda as well, where you remind people that, like, the politicians are also human beings, and they have the human side to their lives that you would never know. I mean, it is unlikely that this would, you know, be front page news on a newspaper. Paper,
no.
But it is one of those stories that, as you say, it like this is an extremely human story, and I'm glad that you were able to bring it to us.
And John McDermott is going to celebrate a birthday, I think, in a couple of weeks. He's going to turn 84, and life is good. Life is good. There we go. That is the On Poly podcast for this Tuesday, February 6, 2024. Remember to listen to the very end to find out what embarrassing comments JMM or I made before we started recording this podcast.
You can follow our show on Apple Podcasts so that you get notified each time a new episode is available. And if you already follow our show, help a friend follow it too.
Any feedback you have, we're happy to hear it, good, bad, or indifferent. Write us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org. Make sure to include your first name, last name, and where you're located.
And before we let you go, we wanted to give you a small update on the podcast, or should we say our video podcast.
Mm-hmm. Starting next week, we are going to be trying something very new and exciting for us. You'll be getting your audio episode in your feed on Fridays, but you can also see our podcast conversation on television every Friday night as the first half of The Agenda. And it will also be available on the TVO Today YouTube channel. So it means our days of wearing t-shirts and jeans are well and truly over.
Wait. Am I no longer allowed to wear jeans? Do I have to?
Well, that's a good question. Are they going to shoot us only from the waist up, or will they?
I mean, I'm not going to come to work in pajamas, but.
No short pants, no pajamas. Maybe we'll let you get away with the blue jeans.
All right.
Our first video podcast will be out February 16th. As we go to this new date and new format, I know other podcasters have been doing this for a while, but it's going to be new for us, and we're pretty chuffed about it, as they say.
Yeah, this will be something new and exciting. I will remind our listeners that of the two of us, I'm the one with zero broadcast training, but I guess it turns out that if you work at a TV station for 10 years, they eventually put you on TV.
There you go, especially if you know what you're talking about. So there you go.
This week's episode was produced and edited by Matthew O'Mara. Our managing editor is Katie O'Connor.
Production support from Christine Gardner and Jonathan Hallowell. Until next Friday, everybody, bye-bye.
See you soon.
Still trying to download. I'm not sure why this isn't downloading. I have a hotspot. There we go. Okay.
Just needed to feel your disapproval.
if only that would always work.